Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, Executive VP of the Center for Security Policy, sitting in for my boss, Frank Gaffney. Today, we have the privilege of talking to Nolan Peterson, who is foreign correspondent for the Daily Signal and who is currently in Ukraine. He has been there and is observing all that's going on, but especially a pretty momentous occasion for the folks there. Nolan, can you tell us a little bit about independence and the 25-year anniversary for them?
Well, thanks for having me on. Yesterday was a really moving day, and I think as an American, it puts a lot of things in perspective. I first came to Ukraine 2 years ago, right after the revolution, and one of my earliest memories of the country was walking around on the Maidan, which is where sort of the epicenter of the revolution in 2014. And I heard somebody say, "Freedom isn't free," and that's sort of a cliche thing to say to in America. You know, we sort of give lip service to the idea a lot. But yesterday, I mean, you look, you know, at this massive military parade going through central Kyiv. But more importantly, when you look at the crowd and you see the young kids on their parents' shoulders waving the Ukrainian flag, and you know, all the millennials for whom the Soviet Union is just a story. It's not even a living memory anymore. And you really see this desire among the Ukrainian people for a better life and to leave that Soviet history behind. And I think it also puts in perspective what they're fighting for out in the East, which is to finally put the nail in the coffin, so to speak, of Russia's attempt to control this country.
Now, that is brilliant and beautiful, and I'm also concerned for them because they may be leaving the remnants of the Soviet Union behind, but Vlad Putin is resurrecting some of that entity in whatever new form it may become. And like you said, the fighting is ongoing and hardly nothing, you know. So can you give us a feel for what their level of concern is for the Russian incursion, the little green men, the armor, the artillery, the bombings, and all of that? Do they see this as a real threat to their independence?
Absolutely. Basically, Russia has punished Ukraine for the 2014 revolution, and that in 2014, you know, the protesters took to the streets of Kyiv and across the country, really, and demanded the ouster of Viktor Yanukovych, the former president of Ukraine. And the sort of the prevalent idea among most of the protesters and among many of them I've spoken to was that they don't want to be like Russia. They want to be part of Europe. They want to be Western Europe, and you see American movies and they see our culture, and they want that. They want that idea of democracy that we don't even really appreciate, to be honest with you. But after the revolution, you know, Russia seized Crimea illegally and then launched this separatist insurrection in the East, which is really a war that Russia has been financing as well as had its own troops fighting in. There's been several ceasefire agreements throughout the conflict. The first one was in September 2014. The second one was in February 2015, but neither one stopped the fighting. I was out last summer, more than 6 months after the second ceasefire was signed. I spent a couple weeks embedded with the Ukrainian military, and it was hell. And we're talking heavy artillery daily, trench warfare, tanks shooting at each other, constant sniper attacks. I'm a former Air Force pilot. I had never in all my time in Afghanistan and Iraq seen anything approximating what I saw in eastern Ukraine. You know, it's heavy warfare. It's quarantined geographically to a very small section of Ukraine. Only about 10% of the country is touched by the war physically. But it's a serious war. And I think that's one aspect of this story that doesn't really make it back to America, is that there is a no-kidding land war going on in Europe right now as we speak. And that's scary.
Nolan, I guess one of the things I'd like to consider, one of the methods that the Soviet Union used to control its satellites was seeding those areas with ethnic Russians. And that's, you know, part of the – in the Crimea and also in parts of Ukraine, there are pockets of Russian speakers, you know, ethnic Russians who may not have the same allegiances as the rest of the Ukrainians who you saw so happily celebrating independence and watching Western movies and wanting to be part of the West. Do you think that there is a possibility that this is something Russia is going to put their foot, their armor, and the rest of their might down on and try to really peel at least that portion of Ukraine off from the rest of the country?
I really believe that it has less to do with pockets of ethnic Russians as it is with pockets of people who are exposed to Russian propaganda. Because here in Kyiv, I'd say two-thirds of the people in the capital city here speak Russian, not Ukrainian. So it's not necessarily that there's a split or schism within Ukraine or within Estonia or any of the Baltic states between ethnic Russians and people who speak other languages or have other cultures. It's more about the people who are exposed to Russian propaganda. I'll give you a really quick story, but I was in eastern Ukraine last year, right after a town called Slavyansk was liberated from the combined Russian separatist army. And I was walking around this village outside of this town that had been leveled by artillery. And I asked people, who destroyed your home? And this place looked like Hiroshima, just totally flattened. And some people would say it was the Ukrainian army who destroyed their homes. And some people said it was the separatists who destroyed their homes. And one family looked at me and they said it was the American CIA bomber planes who attacked them and destroyed their home. And I'm a former Air Force pilot, and I was, in my mind, I'm thinking, what in the heck are you talking about? You know? But I asked them, so why do you think that? What leads you to believe that American B-52s were carpet bombing eastern Ukraine? And they said that they had seen it on the news. And now these are people who had been there for the battle. They were in their basement. And granted, I appreciate the fog of war and how emotions can distort memories. But that just shows you the power of Russian propaganda. They were seeing Russian news. Russian news is telling them that American bombers were bombing them. And they believed it. And so that's, you know, as a former pilot who became a journalist, I see now very clearly how the media and propaganda is a weapon of war, and Russia uses that weapon more effectively than any country I've ever come across.
Well, given those things and given the push they're making, they still haven't gotten past that initial foray. It's still, like you said, very geographically limited to the one small area. And it doesn't seem to be more than almost, like you said, if it's trench warfare, then like World War I, nobody seems to be making particularly big gains either way. Do you think there's enough will on the Russian side to do the enough of a push to actually get over that impasse?
That's a great question. And I think that kind of leads to the inevitable next question, which is, what does Putin want? And there's a million different theories about that. You know, some people think he wants to reconstitute, you know, the Kiev Rus Empire from days of old.
Yeah, Novorossiya or something like that.
Yeah, you know, some people think he just wants to recreate the USSR. I mean, nobody really knows what he wants. But I think what we are seeing, or what we have seen the past couple of years, is that he's able to use the war in the East as a way to basically stall Ukraine's progression toward functioning democracy. Basically, he has ruined the promise of the revolution in Ukraine, or he has delayed the promise of the revolution in Ukraine by diverting a lot of political energy and money in this country toward fighting this war. One thing I have noticed in the last couple of years of reporting on this conflict is that a lot of American foreign policy experts like to analyze Russia's intentions through the lens of what America would want to do. We look at economics and sanctions and all these rational things, but Russians think differently than Americans do. And sanctions don't necessarily work on Russians because they don't, you know, you take away their flat screen TVs and they don't really care, you know? And so I think there is a misperception among many countries in the West about how to deal with that. And I think some of the tools we're using to try and deter Russia aren't necessarily effective.
Well, I think it's you have illuminated many of the factors that I think bear a lot more scrutiny, and we appreciate your heading over there. Happy you saw the Independence Day, and hopefully that will be the status they maintain. Nolan Peterson, foreign correspondent for the Daily Signal, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Up next, we'll be talking with Fred Flights of our own Center for Security Policy about the Obama bomb of an Iran deal. This is Jim Hansen. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, and we are going to talk now with Fred Flights, who is Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy, a former CIA analyst, and the guy we go to when we want to know what is going on with this debacle of an Iran deal. Now, Fred, obviously everyone knows there was a, not a ransom, but a leverage payment made to the Iranians in order to convince them maybe it's a good idea to release the American hostages they'd taken. And there's been, I guess, plenty of coverage of the idea there was a plane flying pallets full of cash in, but there were also, it looks like, a large number of just under $100 million payments, $99,999,000 payments for some reason, in the days directly after that, to total $1.7 billion that we paid the Iranians. What in the world is going on?
It's a strange case, Jim. You may remember the administration insisted that there was no connection whatsoever in this $400 million payment that was made to Iran and the release of the U.S. hostages. Well, the State Department recently said, in fact, this money was being used as leverage and was not provided to the Iranians until the U.S. prisoners were released. So we know that that claim was a lie. But there's a new stunning development that our friend Claudia Rosette recently wrote in the New York Sun. She wrote about this on August 24th, that there were 13 outlays of one penny less than $100 million, which adds up to $1.3 billion minus maybe 13 cents, I think is what James Rosen said. This was transferred from the Treasury Department to the State Department to pay foreign claims. The State Department will not admit what this money was for, and if it was sent to Iran, they won't talk about it. The Obama administration is refusing to cooperate with any investigation about this. Obviously, this money was the interest on the $400 million. The administration said it would pay that, the $400 million, which it says that it owed to Iran. And obviously, the administration found another way to provide this money to Iran.
So, Fred, overall, this seems to be just the last, or probably not even the last, nail in the coffin for proving this deal was something that should be torn up on day one of the next president's administration. Is there any more revelations we should be looking for or other things people should hear about this?
Well, I'm concerned that the Iranian government is going to press for more concessions until the day Barack Obama leaves office, until January.
Because they seem to be getting them, so why not?
That's right. Obama sees this as his legacy agreement as president. And we already know the Iranians are claiming that they think that the deal was unfair, that they didn't get enough concessions. They demanded access to the U.S. financial system. They demanded other payments. So I'm worried what else is going to happen between now and January 20th.
I'm actually sorely worried about what could happen in the days between the election and the time he actually packs and finally leaves the White House. It's kind of horrifying. Let's segue a little bit into someone who thinks she'd like to move back into the White House, Hillary Clinton, and the Clinton Foundation, which was fully operational, bringing in satchels of cash and probably pallets of cash on unmarked planes as well during her tenure as Secretary of State. Now, the campaign has announced that they will stop parts of it, at least, not all of it, taking money in the Clinton Foundation from foreign governments and tyrants and bad actors around the world if she's elected president. Why in the world didn't they do that when she was working and acting as Secretary of State? Because they were sure raking in the money then.
There's so much to talk about here. First of all, Mrs. Clinton agreed with the Obama administration that she would avoid conflicts like this. That is, the pay-for-play situations where Clinton donors got access to her. We know that that happened. I'm really concerned that foreign donors are contributing to the Clinton Foundation right now while she's a candidate to buy influence with her if she wins the election. The foundation should be shut down immediately. We're now hearing that's not going to happen. There's going to be a glitzy Clinton Foundation conference next month. The foundation will only stop taking foreign donors if she wins the election, and Chelsea Clinton will continue to run it. This is unacceptable. This thing should be shut down or it should be merged with a legitimate charity. It's not a legitimate charity. This is pay for play. It's a slush fund for the Clintons, and it's put U.S. national security at risk.
I think that's something, like I said, I'm stunned she got away with doing this while she was Secretary of State. But we do, you know, we instead of an actual media covering Democratic leaders, we have the Guild of Palace Scribes who simply do the will of the leaders of the Democratic Party. But even now, it seems like there are cracks in the facade, and the AP and some of the other major organizations are at least covering this. Do you think there's any redemption? I mean, like you said, if I was a foreign bad guy, I would be sending plane loads of cash to the Clinton Foundation right now while I still could before, you know, supposedly this window of opportunity to bribe your way to what you want from the Clintons gets shut down or at least curtailed.
Well, let me talk very quickly about Uranium One. This is a Canadian company that Russia acquired in the early Obama administration days, and Uranium One had access to control of a significant amount of America's uranium market. Now, the U.S. government had to approve this purchase because it's a strategic asset. And Clinton's defenders are saying, well, you know, this is an interagency deal. She had nothing to do with it. Uranium One made $400 million in contributions to the Clinton Foundation while this decision was being made. Come on now, Jim. I mean, is this not a smoking gun? Would anyone else on earth get away with such an obvious and blatant act of corruption?
I don't think anyone else would, but she has. And again, we seem to have a, if not disinterested, or not even disinterested, a complicit media in pretending that these things are not. It's kind of funny. Hillary's answer today to the idea that these are a problem, that there is pay for play, as you mentioned, when it's blatantly obvious, when it's already proven, was that this is a lot of smoke, but there's no fire. I mean, that's a horrible denial at best. But in the end, it's a non-denial. She's saying, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on, but you can't prove it. And is there any chance she'll be held legitimately accountable for this? I mean, she is in the public eye for at least the next couple of months. Can somebody put her feet to the fire?
Well, there is an effort to charge her for perjury, for lying under oath to Congress. I don't know if that'll go anywhere. The only way she'll be held legally accountable if Donald Trump wins the election, in which case he may prosecute her. Otherwise, I think she's going to get off with being the most corrupt U.S. official in American history.
Fred, one more thing I wanted to ask you. You wrote a piece discussing whether or not President Obama and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, were responsible for the birth of ISIS, given that it was their policies that created the vacuum which ISIS grew in and also the Iranians gained influence in. Hit us with a little bit of your thoughts on why they do own that terror state.
Well, Donald Trump has called them the co-founders of ISIS. Now, maybe he went too far in saying that. But there's no doubt that they're responsible for the birth of ISIS because of the policies they advocated that led to the sectarian dispute in Iraq by not leaving behind a small U.S. force in Iraq, as the president's military advisors asked him to do. But the president and Mrs. Clinton would in turn pull all U.S. troops out of Iraq and did not care about the consequences. This is why the sectarian conflict came back, which allowed Al-Qaeda in Iraq to rise from the ashes and morph into ISIS. This is Mrs. Clinton's fault. It happened on her watch. She can pretend that she's not responsible for it, but the fact that she ignored the situation in Iraq and approved this decision with the president is why ISIS exists today and exists all over the world as a major component of the global jihad movement.
Fred Flights, Senior VP for Policy and Programs, thank you so much for joining us. Up next, we'll be talking with Ken Timmerman, President and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, better known as CFIUS, is supposed to prevent foreigners from making national security-threatening investments in this country. Unfortunately, it's run by the Treasury Department, which has the responsibility for promoting such cash infusions from overseas and rarely sees one it dislikes. Take the $43 billion transaction CFIUS just approved. A communist Chinese state-owned chemical company is now one step closer to buying Switzerland's Syngenta, a leading manufacturer of pesticides, herbicides, and other agribusiness products. Syngenta has plants in the United States that involve the handling of hazardous chemicals and directly impact our food supply. What could possibly go wrong? The short answer is a lot. China is increasingly aggressive, and there is a distinct possibility of conflict. This is no time to be giving it control of potential time bombs in this country. This is Frank Gaffney.
Life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
This is Jim Hansen, and we're back now with more Secure Freedom Radio, talking to Ken Timmerman, who is president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran and author of Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi. He also has a new book, Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Thanks for having me on, Jim.
Well, let's dig into Madam Clinton and what she's got going on. And there were some revelations recently, which weren't revelations, I imagine, to you, and certainly weren't to me or anyone who's been paying attention to Hillary's bad connections. But her aide-de-camp, her partner in crime, Huma Abedin, was in the news in the New York Post by Paul Sperry's amazing piece, pointing out just exactly how bad the organization Huma Abedin previously worked for, the Journal of Muslim Minority Affairs, was, her mother's pieces, some of the stuff others wrote there, and basically raising the questions of how does a woman with ties to this Muslim Brotherhood organ get to be the number two person next to the Secretary of State, and even, in my opinion, hold any kind of security clearance? What's going on here?
Well, you know, Mrs. Clinton has called her for some years her second daughter, right? She worked as an intern in the White House. She must be the only female intern that worked at the Clinton White House that wasn't accosted by Bill Clinton. But she was detailed to Mrs. Clinton, so maybe there's something else going on that score. But look, she became very close to Mrs. Clinton, both personally and as a, as you say, a gal Friday. But let me just drill down on one thing I think is tremendously important. I've followed up on Paul Sperry's piece. As you know, I've been following this for many years as well, just as you and Frank certainly have. This is not guilt by association. Okay. People try to sweep this under the rug, saying, well, she was associated with this review. She didn't have any active role. No, no, no. She was in a leadership position of this journal, which was set up by the Muslim World League, a group which helped spawn Al-Qaeda, with money from the king of Saudi Arabia. Her father, in setting up the institute that was the that spawned this journal of Muslim Minority Affairs, laid out what their goal was. And their goal, in his own papers, was to spread Sharia law throughout the world and to shore up the minority Muslim communities. In other words, the countries where Muslims were a minority, France, Germany, the United States of America, to teach them what Sharia was, what it meant, and what they had to do as they lived in a minority until the day came when they were a majority. So this is not guilt by association. She played an active role in an organization whose explicit goal was to conquer the West in the name of Islam.
Yeah, it's almost as if they have a plan and they've been implementing it for 50 some odd years, as folks who have been following this have pointed out repeatedly in documents such as the explanatory memorandum for the Muslim Brotherhood here in the United States and the project and other pieces that point out that the Muslim Brotherhood is not simply a human rights organization or a religious organization. They are part of a plan for global conquest. Now, I heard the Clinton campaign, when asked about Huma's association here, they refused to answer the simple question as to whether Huma was paid for her role there. But if they refused to answer whether she was paid, I think that's a little bit of a smoking gun as to whether or not she was actually involved.
You would think that if she was not paid, they would answer that immediately. By the way, I'm not so sure that makes that big a difference. There's lots of organizations where you have unpaid editors and people who take part in the leadership of a group like this. But the fact that they will not answer that question, I think, is very significant.
And it's a family business. Obviously, her mom works there. You know, it's part of the institute her father founded. You mentioned they were interested in promulgating Sharia law around the world. Her mother has written pieces talking about how the benevolence of Islam and Sharia in putting women in a subordinate role is something to be envied, because then it takes the responsibility off women to provide for the family. I mean, it is some pretty regressive, patriarchal, oppressive stuff that if it was coming from anyone, anything but Islamists, the feminist West, liberals, and the rest would be losing their minds over. They would be, if this was Christianists, this mythical group of modern-day crusaders who they like to pretend are a problem, they would be losing their minds and talking about it every day. But somehow, you know, professing the idea that patriarchal oppression of women is a good thing if it comes from Islam seems to be just fine with them.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and you're absolutely correct about that, and that's exactly what this Journal of Muslim Minority Affairs was preaching. You know, in my new book, I talk about Mrs. Clinton's efforts to impose Islamic Sharia blasphemy laws here in the United States. So this is all part of a piece, okay? Mrs. Clinton worked with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation in 2010, 2011, to get the United Nations General Assembly to adopt Resolution 1618, which essentially encourages Western countries to use existing hate crime legislation to criminalize speech that against Islam. And this is very significant, because this has never happened in the past. And that resolution was passed in 2011 by Mrs. Clinton when Huma Abedin was there. I want to read you just one very short thing. Representative Trent Franks, who I know comes on this show frequently, he had a Justice Department official, Tom Perez, in for a hearing. Now, Tom Perez, remember, was being considered by Mrs. Clinton as a vice presidential nominee, in other words, her partner in this campaign. So he's a significant individual. And Mr. Franks asked him, will you tell us here today that this administration's Department of Justice will never entertain or advance a proposal that criminalizes speech against any religion. And Perez would not answer. He started to talk about hate speech. He started to talk about racist speech, about this or about that. But he would not give a yes or no answer four times. So you have to conclude from that, that this is something that they were really seriously thinking about, they were working on. And I argue in my new book, Deception, the maker of the YouTube video that Hillary and Obama blamed for Benghazi, Nakula, Vasily Nakula, was the first victim of these Islamic Sharia blasphemy laws. They threw him in jail for a year for making a movie.
You would think if you ask someone, will you be part of criminalizing free speech? And we're not talking about incitement to violence per Brandenburg. You know, right. That's the decision that matters. It says in order for speech to be criminalized or prohibited, it has to be actively inciting imminent violence. She's talking, he's talking, and the rest of these people are talking about speech that is simply offensive or bothers Muslims. They say you can't talk about Prophet Muhammad. You can't denigrate Islam. Well, yes, you can. Yes, you can. And that's the entire reason that we have the First Amendment, is because the speech that bothers other people and offends them is the speech that most needs protection. And the idea that these people can't bring themselves to say that they will not be involved in this shows they are. Hillary, I think you made an amazingly important point. Hillary was trying to help the UN do this worldwide. And in the course of that, she had to point out to them, now we can't really do that in the United States because of that old pesky First Amendment, but we can use shaming and shunning and other things to try and accomplish the same thing. It's disgraceful, and for anyone who believes in our Constitution, should be a disqualifying factor for someone who wants to be president.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and it shows that she has no respect for the Constitution, for our First Amendment freedoms. And by the way, they did use that. It wasn't shaming and shunning that put Nakula behind bars for a year after the Benghazi attacks. He was sent to jail because his movie, his First Amendment expression, right, however bad it might have been, however amateur it might have been, his movie offended people, and he was put in jail because of it.
And unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the last one. I think this has been something they've shown to be interested in doing and will do if they gain power. Ken Timmerman, thanks so much for being with us. He is the author of a book, Deception, the making of the YouTube video Hillary and Obama blamed for Benghazi, and president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. Up next, we'll be talking with Claudia Rosette, foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum and a columnist at Forbes, about more on the Iran ransom and other debacles and corruption. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Jim Hansen, and we're back with more Secure Freedom Radio. Joined this segment by Claudia Rosette, who is foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, columnist at Forbes, and a contributing editor at the New York Sun, where she dropped an amazing piece this week, figuring out another piece of the horrible puzzle that is the Iran deal. Now, this debacle, this horrendous transformation of our foreign policy into a pay-for-play hostage ransom and legalization of the Iranian nuclear program is so bad in so many ways, it's always stunning to see another giant horribleness come into the light of day. Now, Claudia, Fred Flights mentioned this earlier in the show, but can you tell us just exactly what the story is behind these one penny under $100 million payments to Iran we're all about?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm still trying to figure out exactly why this happened, because it was striking. Well, what got my attention when I went looking sort of deep in the database of this judgment fund the Treasury maintains to pay out awards against the U.S. government was this series of 19 payments for, you know, 10 digits, ten nines, just a penny each under $100 million. And the administration still won't say exactly why. Why was that number picked? In other words, they broke out a payment of $1.3 billion into 13 smaller payments, plus there's a 14th payment for about $10.4 million. So it looks like it was a total sum of $1.31 billion and change. I can tell you, however, the effect it had. We know that. And that was basically to hide it in plain sight. While the administration, for more than 7 months, refused to answer questions about exactly when this $1.3 billion component of the $1.7 billion settlement to Iran was sent. And the timing of it, which was these payments went through on January 19th, a Tuesday. Now, the settlement was announced on Sunday, January 17th, just 2 days before. The day in between was a federal holiday, Martin Luther King Day. So we now know the $400 million in cash component of the $1.7 billion award was delivered to Iran the same day that President Obama announced it, in cash. A further question is exactly how was that transmitted? Well, this fund likes to send the payments electronically. If that is how they went, and so far it looks likely, although it could have been exchanged into cash further along the line before reaching Iran, we still don't know. But just how it went, so far, it looks most likely that it was transferred electronically, wired out of the judgment fund, in which case President Obama defended the cash payment that was made on the Sunday on grounds that we have no banking relationship with Iran, so we had to send it in cash. But if they then, 2 days later, sent an even bigger payment of $1.3 billion electronically, the mendacity here just keeps compounding. Which was it? And what are we actually talking about here? The $1.3 billion comes from a fund where if there's no legal appropriation for the money it's paying out, it simply sends it. And that's your tax money. Those are U.S. tax dollars. Staggering.
Now, Claudia, the Congress, in their role doing oversight to make sure that the executive branch cannot do things like pay ransom for U.S. citizens or, you know, enact treaties without their consent, or spend, in this case, almost $1.7 billion without accountability, has been asking questions of the Obama administration about this. And thus far, the answer has been the hand pointed out saying, no thanks, we're not going to answer. Is there any way they can get away with not answering questions on this and just tell Congress to pound sand?
I hope not, because it really does matter. They should be accountable for this. What was listed in such a way, you won't find it by searching the database for Iran or anything like that. You find it by looking through, you know, I saw it by going through state payments on behalf of the State Department line by line. And there was this lineup, this amazing lineup of these 99999, et cetera, payments. And what Congress needs to do, there are forms at Treasury that have to be filled out for this that will give you exactly where that money was wired to, if there was a check issued somewhere, how it left Treasury and bound for where. Was it sent into some place under custody of the State Department, which then transferred it on in some form, cash or otherwise, or transfer or what to where? We need the rest of that trail. These are questions Congress should be asking. They should be within its rights to get. Again, this is taxpayer money. This is a very strange and sort of disturbing fund, which is called, they call it an open-ended appropriation. Okay, so what is that? And it's something Congress ought to be considering in any event. This has fleshed out the extent to which payments are now going out of this fund. You know, $1.3 billion left that fund in a single day. And the administration managed to cover it up for more than half a year simply by breaking it down. Now, was it broken down for technical reasons? Perhaps. They served the function of covering it up. Was it broken down as a deliberate cover-up? We don't have evidence of that, but it's a question where is it clear that the answer is no. It's one of the open questions.
Common sense would say yes to that.
Well, if you or I did that with a payment to somebody connected with Iran, you know, it would get attention. Actually, if we did it with respect to running a grocery business, what it looks like is something called structuring, which is precisely an attempt to avoid oversight, to avoid attracting, you know, to keep just under some limit.
It's again, like when drug dealers deposit an amount just under the reporting level so they don't have to have their cash and businesses scrutinized. This is the external version of that.
Correct. And again, we don't yet know if that was the intention here, but that was, if it worked, that was the effect, and it worked remarkably well for some time. And it took, again, both state and Treasury on this have been stonewalling to just an extraordinary extent. The most transparent administration ever keeps coming back with replies that basically say, we have no information for you on that. The State Department has been saying since January, we don't have anything to tell you. We don't know. The spokesman there earlier this month said, I don't have the date on which the money went out. Well, that $1 billion he was talking about went out of Treasury, we see on the database, on that Tuesday, within 2 days of the $400 million cash payment. State had to know that. State was the agency on the behalf of which Treasury was paying that money out of this judgment fund. They had to know. So when he said, I don't have anything for you on that. Yeah, at this point, if the State Department won't let its own press people say something like that, the date on which $1.3 billion in U.S. tax dollars was paid out to the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism in a deal that President Obama called above board, after the Wall Street Journal broke the story of the $400 million cash shipment early this month, President Obama had a press conference at the Pentagon in which he mocked people who thought that the cash was news. You know, he said, this was all known, we announced it in January, and who cares if it was cash? That just sounds like some spy novel stuff. Well, Jim, the reason that that sounds like spy novel or crime novel, thriller, the reason it sounds that way is because that is the way that things get done in the underworld. That's not, and if this was an above-board terrific settlement, as the administration claimed, the administration should have been forthcoming immediately.
Claudia Resett, thank you so much for keeping an eye on this. I have a feeling we'll be discussing this more, and your reporting has been leading the way as always. This is Jim Hansen. That's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. We'll be back tomorrow with more ammunition for your use in the war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.